Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Before we begin today's program, I have a quick Mythic Atlantis segment. By exploring the legends and lore of Lost Atlantis, we hope to learn from the mythic civilization's epic triumphs and tragic mistakes. These lessons will hopefully guide us in making wiser choices in the here and now that will positively impact our collective futures. Now, television has been a great tool for learning about Atlantis, and Hercules movies have, under a plethora of titles, enjoyed plenty of airtime on TV. And television has attempted to reintroduce the strongman hero of Greek mythology into our lives on numerous occasions. The most successful of these programs was Hercules: The Legendary Journeys. This multimedia epic took Hercules to Atlantis just in time to witness its destruction. Warning, spoilers ahead. Hercules: The Legendary Journeys, Season 3, Episode 22, Disc Number 8. Hercules finds himself awakening on Atlantis after falling off the seabearing vessel of Captain Demetrius. He was found by Cassandra, a young Atlantean woman plagued by visions of her island home's destruction. Under King Pentheus, Atlantis' progressive but despotic ruler, the island has advanced technologically by mastering the mysteries of crystals. Airships patrol the land, and the power structure deploys deadly energy weapons. But reason and science have supplanted belief in the gods and other superstitions, making Cassandra's visions both suspect and subversive. An attempt to warn the government of the island's impending doom leads to imprisonment and torture. Hercules breaks free, locates and frees Captain Demetrius and his crew from the mines, then rescues Cassandra as Atlantis sinks into the sea. An airship glides them toward the vessel appropriated by Captain Demetrius, his crew, and the freed mine slaves. Note, Cassandra returns in Hercules: The Legendary Journeys, Season 4, Episode 10, Hercules on Trial, to testify on behalf of her friend and defend the heroic path he trends from its detractors. Now we're going to listen to a quick song, and then we will proceed.
Sing with me, Halloween.
Greetings and welcome back to Mages, Sages, and Seers. I am Hercules Invictus, and that was Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin. And now we welcome Frater Serpentis Satori. Greetings and welcome, Satori. How are you?
All right. It's been an interesting day already.
In a good way, I hope.
Oh, I know. We had eclipse, so you just brace for it.
So what type of events have been unfolding that you can share?
Let's go back to that. We deal with everything we want to deal with at the top. Because you wanted to talk about the misinformation versus information thing.
Right. That's
the CNN,
the CNN
versus Fox study.
Uh-huh.
And I want to cover some YouTube, which is I respect.
Okay.
And then we'll get to real time today and then get to the topic.
Before we start on the topic, I'm just going to preface it a little bit. As everyone who listens to the podcast, or watches the videos, or follows me on social media knows, right now I'm doing a very big Atlantis-themed exploration. And what's different about this than most Atlantis-themed explorations is I'm not looking for the truth about Atlantis. I'm exploring the stories about Atlantis and the effects the stories have on the people that ascribe to these a particular set of beliefs. And Atlantis is all this and more because not only was it inspired by actualities that still remain misty in our eyes, but it's become something real in our collective conscience, and it's developed a mythology all its own. So I view information in much the same way. We're told stories and we live in stories. And sometimes stories are empowering and they're illuminating, and sometimes they're disempowering and they cause confusion. And it seems like we've lost the ability to choose our stories wisely or to gain and grant veracity to some things more than other things. So now it's just kind of people falling victim to all sorts of stories without the stories being based thing that we would have considered truth not too long ago. So our current conversation takes place within that greater dialogue.
Well, I mean, one of the things in the beginning with Hercules Invictus, at least when I entered, was the whole thing about not being a victim.
Correct. That's still very much a part of it.
And part of misinformation and propaganda is someone is telling you what to think.
Right. They're disempowering you by telling you that you're a victim, that you are in the throes of something much greater than you, that you don't see very clearly and can't understand. And there's all these nefarious powers that control the world that are out to get you.
Yeah. And it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to take this to that interesting study about if you pay people not to watch Fox News, if you
right.
pay them to watch CNN, they do eventually realize what the truth is.
Right. Or that they get a story that's less tainted by propaganda.
Right.
And when
they paid people to do this, when they paid people, well, because this is right when Kenosha happened. The original study is Rittenhouse and Kenosha happened. So they have to watch CNN about Kenosha, not Fox. And that changes their version of the narrative because it's not about victimization. It's about he shot a guy with a skateboard. One of the weapons in question is a skateboard.
Right.
And so the people that were part of the study saw that maybe Fox News wasn't telling them the truth.
Right, and they grew to develop a different set of standards in judging what the truth happens to be and what information they're receiving happens to be have more veracity than other information they've been receiving up until then, and which interpretations stick closer to the facts in what they've been listening to.
Right. And so very slowly that's able to change their minds and make them think about facts again.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than anger or however that works on social media.
Well, there's outrage, and outrage seems to be on both sides. And on those sides, it seems to be news is presented in such a way, information is provided in such a way as to cause outrage. And it becomes almost like a creature that feeds on outrage. And it doesn't matter what you happen to believe as long as you're outraged about it.
That's what happens when you believe the other side is evil and sacrificing babies.
Yes. And that's a very old story, as we both know.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to Cleopatra.
Yes, blood libel and ceremonies of the Jewish people. Later on, it was the Christians that got blamed for participating in these practices and the drinking the blood and eating the body of their savior was not only deicide, but it was cannibalism in the eyes of very many people in antiquity.
Even though there really is an Egyptian origin for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so, that if people have a real news source like CNN or a real news app, they aren't quite as prone to believe the outrage.
Right. But again, recognizing that too, that even more reliable media has a bias often, and the bias is not always very clear when you're listening to it. But collectively over time, you see that the narrative is biased, but not as biased as some of the other information sources that somebody might go to for information. My aunt, when she was alive, she would listen to right-wing radio all the time, and she was always outraged and always felt the presence of nefarious social forces that were out to get her and enslave everybody and destroy everybody and send everybody to hell and things like that. And it deprived her of enjoying what life she had. And it definitely lessened the quality of life that she had remaining because she had all this fear about all of these things happening. So it robbed her of what she could have experienced during her last days.
Well, maybe we'll skip YouTube riches and go right to Moon Knight and the end. And why you are judged at the end. And go back to what do you say about that next time or so.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
Well, because the Egyptian idea is your heart is lighter than a feather. Your heart is lighter than your ma'at, your purpose. And if you get too hung up on anything... You aren't going to the field of reeds. You're too hung up on something. And that was the Egyptian standard. But their society was very heavily bound in their religion.
Mm-hmm.
So there are biases within that system too. But on some level, as someone who spends a lot of time in the underworld, we all need to think about the fact that the judgment is the judgment, and we're all going to have to deal with the judgment when that day comes. And as always, I have to explain, the difference between normal people and ghosts is that ghosts don't want to be judged. You become a ghost because you don't want to deal with the courtroom drama.
Now, I cultivated the practice a long time ago, and it's not a daily practice, but it's an almost daily practice of reviewing my day and looking into the past for like recurring patterns that I've lived through, and then trying to basically accept responsibility for the things that I myself brought about that affected not only my life, but the lives of other people on my path. And this I find to be a cathartic and lightening practice, because you could let go of things that are churning around inside of you. So I imagine that whatever judging takes place after I'm no longer here will be along the same lines. Plus, I had a near-death experience once very many years ago, and that seemed to be a visiting of various points in my life that were tied together by theme. It wasn't chronological, but it led to my seeing things out of sequence and out of linear time, where the message was very clear for me to see. What I could have or did learn from the events became very apparent. So I have a difficult time understanding the not wanting to face the judgment part, because at one point or another, whether you choose to be a ghost or to go through with it, you're going to have to do it to move on.
And the Supernatural episode where they had all of those ghosts was a really good demonstration of this. Where they have the three interlocked ghosts, whatever episode that was.
I'm getting faint remembrances, but it's been a while since I saw Supernatural.
It's been a while since I've seen it too, but I remember there was the episode where the ghosts create other ghosts.
Uh-huh.
And that's the whole problem is that, well, let's move this to the larger topic, that maybe the definition of religion is your code and your diet.
Okay.
Maybe. What makes the difference between people who serve the Morrigan and people who serve Hecate is people who serve Hecate serve a different idea about civilization than the Celts do. Or, Tony Soprano said the thing about, if I eat a steak, Hindus think I'm going to hell. Which is one of his most famous quotes, and he's Tony Soprano.
Mm-hmm.
That on some level, as a polytheist, I've always been of the opinion that your patron and the code that comes with that does end up defining you, because it ends up defining you by being the code of ethics under which you choose to be judged. And so as a polytheist, you can choose to serve any god, but you have to understand what the rules are.
And it depends on
and
which
that is not well represented anymore.
No, it depends too on which aspect of the god you wish to follow. Like the strongman hero god, which manifests in the Greco-Roman cultures as Hercules or Heracles, and several other names that are a bit more obscure, there are various points in his development, and each stage in his development represents a different set of challenges and realizations, and marks a certain terrain of growth. So they're not, although they're phases and stages of one greater development, they're very different from one another. So what you do if you're following the youthful, heroic Fighting Monsters Hercules is very different than if you follow the Porter of Heaven, bringer of divine messages Hercules that's there during a stage in his development.
Yeah. But on a level, if you're trying to go to Elysium or Valhalla or whatever.
Right.
The rules are pretty clear about how to get into Valhalla.
Right.
And on some level, that's what we're really saying about the heart judgment, is that at a certain point you chose a god and a path, and that's the way forward for yourself. Because you have chosen to deal with that, even when it isn't very much fun.
If you want to build a particular type of body, you need to do a particular set of exercises in a particular way with particular tools to get the result that you're looking for. And you can exercise all you want, but if you're not following the rules for what you want, you won't get the type of body that you're aiming for. So it's the same with spiritual disciplines as well. Unless you follow the procedures and actually do it, you're not going to, you might get somewhere interesting, but it won't be where you're aiming to go.
Right.
And that leads to a very interesting question, the heroic or the deific as a path of becoming. And it becomes more understandable that way. There's less guesswork. It's which quality or which aspect of the god or the divine personage do you resonate with, and what do you identify with, and what is left, and is that the road of your development to embody and express the more fullness of the deific imago that you're striving towards? And this could be viewed as an exemplar, as a paragon. Again, there are numerous ways of approaching that.
Yeah, but it's the basic question about, like, what do I want? How do I want it? And that to have that God helping me means I have to play by certain rules. It's very different if you're having Thor help you versus Honshu. Because that's a very obvious Marvel thing right now.
Yes, it is. And Marvel has plunged into those questions with its entertainment.
Yeah. And so that's not an unusual question right now, especially not with Moon Knight dealing with the judgment at the end of the story. It comes about, why did you choose this god and why did you choose this path? Although not everyone, a lot of people feel like they were AP classed and like their patron picked them and they signed something.
It's phrased like that often.
Back in New Orleans in the 80s, it felt like that. It felt like there were some of us that decided we liked our government and we were going to do what our government thought was fine. And then you question your government. And then you end up like Thor in the Marvel Universe, and then you end up like Honshu. Because then you end up wondering, Why did I think this guy knew better?
Now we know.
But as a Roman who works with Hindus and agrees with Tony Soprano's comment, the Hindus understand that on a larger level, I agree with them. I agree with them that everyone is God. I agree with we can't really know God, but we can know each other. So the Irish witches in my life have always wondered where that puts me on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And my normal answer is Hecate is one of those goddesses that Hecate is Hecate. You can round her into other things. Hecate is one of those goddesses that doesn't really fit in other boxes because when you strip her of her cultural context, Durga is not Hecate. The Morrigan's not Hecate. They're similar, being dark goddesses, but they're not the same. And that is the whole, like, guild of dark goddess worshippers thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's true enough. That people that worship the dark goddesses don't really want to talk about what we do to the rest of you because we'll be judged. There's a certain sense of truth to Hecate is one of those goddesses that is very difficult to summarize. So those of us that serve her always are the outsiders because we always feel like we're speaking for a very small opinion that is normal in our house. And the rest of you don't quite know what to do with. Okay, so what happened before I came on?
Okay.
Was that there's a thing in Chicago with the public transportation not working very good this weekend. So when I got on the Red Line yesterday, and sat down at the obvious next chair, written on the train itself was something for Papa Legba.
Okay.
Which a normal person wouldn't give a second thought to, but because my whole day was about how transportation was malfunctioning, seeing that made me laugh. And then after I deal with the fact that there is no bus because the city's freaking out about what happened with the shooting at Millennium Park last night, I have to think about these things. So when I go across the street to get rum for tonight for a Legua on Monday, the song that's playing at the liquor store is I Don't Practice Santeria.
Okay.
Which would be like the most ironic song ever. Considering that song came out when I did work at Reverend Zombies. And if you have an Allegra head, that's just funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy who works there, who sees me occasionally, like, no, that's why I'm buying the rum, the Santeria. That's why you have the good rum you have, because of them. Like, oh, right. But considering the eclipse and how the eclipse has mess things up all week, it's interesting that when I went in there to do the rum thing, that just happened to coincidentally be the song.
Right. Synchronicity is once you're aware of them and once you're on the spiritual path, synchronicities happen at a noticeable, I won't say disturbing, but noticeable rate where they become part of your existence and they become a means that the universe uses to communicate with you.
Yeah, that song is especially interesting considering that song only got radio play. It came out like a month before, but that song was a popular song the weekend I got my Allegra head at the place in New Orleans. And everything about that song is ironic if you actually worked at Reverend Zombies and Marie Laveau's. So hearing it today, right before we started, was an interesting little message considering we're talking about gods and paths and judgment. Why you choose that god to be your guide through your life. Because we would all be different if we had chosen. I'd be a very different person if the Morrigan were my patron rather than Hecate. I would be a very different person if Hercules was my main god, not Hecate.
I can understand
but
that.
But for reasons, what?
I can definitely understand that. I've played hide and seek with my god for a big part of my early life, and I tried following the paths of several of his different cultural manifestations. And even though it was the same god behind all the masks, each mask was very different in what it required and what it taught.
Yeah, Michael is very different from Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
And Horus has very different rules. Because, again, we're back to rules and judgment.
Right.
That the boundary between Hercules and Horus has to do with the negative confession the Egyptians are into, whereas the Greeks are more into being heroic.
Right.
We don't really care about all those rules so much, so long as we think we're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an advantage and disadvantage at the same time.
Of course, as are all the paths, they have their strengths, they have their weaknesses, they have their the things that they teach you, and then the things that they don't quite teach you, and you need to figure out on your own.
And I think in this age of dumbed-down witchcraft, people aren't really thinking about that. They're thinking too much about, like, such goddess chose me, not thinking about the boundaries between, like, Isis and Hecate and the Morrigan on some level amount to where do you want to go when you die? Do you want to go to the Morrigan's Island? Do you want to go to Elysium? Do you want to go to Isis Heaven? Because maybe that, from a polytheist point of view, really is the truth.
Well, I've always understood it that basically, yes, you know, if you want to go into one of the heavens that are shared through religion and mythology, you need to, you know, basically qualify to go there. The same as any club you belong to when you're here, like if you're a Mason, if you're a Rotarian, you know, if you want to be part of it, you need to buy into it. Be a member in good standing. But they're also generic heavens. You know, there are after-death states that aren't so religiously focused. But if you want to go to a religiously focused one, you need to be a good member.
Yeah. You need to pay your dues and you need to
attend meetings.
Be good in the army. Because I've had this conflict my whole life with the Morrigan,
mm-hmm.
because in this world, I am a child of Hecate, not a child of the Morrigan. And the children of Morrigan don't necessarily know that when they meet me.
I have an interesting relationship with the Morrigan. The Morrigan is dark Athena for the Celts in some respects. She's the trainer and nurturer of heroes. And she married the Dagda, who can be interpreted as a mask of Hercules. And in some of the older cultures, pre-Greek, like the Troy and Etruria and Lemnos, Hercules and Athena were basically man and wife, and Martus or Mars or Ares was their son. So you have the Tuatha De, the founder of the Tuatha De and the father of the Tuatha De, with dark Athena. And we got married on Halloween, which was when they had their marriage in honor of the Celtic aspects of our divinities. Because I am Greek by birth and by nurture, and Athena is very much a Celt. So we honored, and we still honor both traditions, plus some other traditions that we found resonance with over the years.
Yeah, that's the best way to do things, but that's also part of the question about where we are today, about the hard judgment and what is religion. Because I hadn't really thought about it too much till I ended up a Roman living among Puerto Ricans and working for Hindus. And religion became a side issue because the Hindus all want to know I'm not Catholic, and so do the Puerto Ricans. And I've explained I'm not Catholic, but maybe because of Hecate, I'm not really part of your system anyway. Maybe Hecate does her own thing like the Morrigan does her own thing.
But there are lots of interesting interrelationships. Like, for instance, as you know, Hercules and Hecate share in Rome a feast week, and in some traditions the same day. And Hecate has been very much a part of my life, very generously appearing at the various points and doing things that later on were actually quite miraculous, and also being very, very generous with sending her children to assist me in various points of my life mission, as you know. So Hecate, we have an altar to Hecate. Athena is more attuned to her than I am in terms of some of the things that you share with me. Athena will have already done them before you shared them with me. So that's, again, my way of synchronistically testing the veracity of these messages that are coming from the beyond. Sometimes a god or a goddess will play that background role where they're not like directly involved, but their hand is felt throughout your life, and there's a relationship there, whether it be a good relationship or a troubled relationship, there is a relationship there.
Well, I thought you and I were talking about the Hercules Disney cartoon.
Yes,
the Hercules Disney cartoon has Hera. Hera's That's not an evil Hera.
No. And she's not evil in the
That
atrocity.
Version of Hera is not evil. That version of Hera really does try to help Hercules when he listens to her.
Yes, in the Etruscan, she's his loving mother. She's not his stepmother.
Right.
She's his mother. There is no conflict behind them. The different versions of the myth reflect very much the cultures in which they've taken root in and that they're expressing themselves through.
Well, that always happens, but that's yet another example of today in the West, we have a very negative view of Hera.
Yes.
Because Hera, for 200 years, has not been understood. We don't have empathy for Hera right now, although we should, because with what's going on in the Western world, we should have more empathy for Hera. Because on some level, Hera represents what's right. And that's why Hercules is her champion. Because Zeus is the king. He's just doing what's political. There's a level where that's true.
A level, yeah. I see Zeus and Hera as not being at odds with each other. Theirs is like many of his relationships in the Eros Gamos, where you know, he is anchored in a particular community, and the goddesses were all very regional. I see Zeus more as the visionary. He developed and actualized the Olympian ideal and all it stands for. He gave structure to society. So yes, he's the king, and sometimes he was a good king, and sometimes he was not a good king. There are lessons in kingship that one must learn, and Zeus so generously shared them. But he's the visionary leader. He's the charismatic leader. He's the inspiring, you know, leader. He's the progressive
leader. He's a democratic leader after the guys who came before him.
Yes.
Because both of the guys who came before him were not democratic leaders.
No, Uranus was, what do you call it, unbridled creativity, which can stifle, even though it sounds liberating, if it's not controlled, it's stifling and oppressive.
It's Thanos. It's Thanos in the MCU.
Yes. And Kronos is the opposite. Kronos is meticulous with his rules and everything to run smoothly. There are rules and schedules and things like that, which can also become stifling and oppressive.
Which is Super Ultron, which is the What If Ultron. Right. So somewhere in the middle, even the Greek gods realize we need to listen to everybody.
Right. They're each different, and they each have lessons to teach. Like, I never saw Kronos as the bad guy. In a lot of the Hellenic pagan or polytheistic community, Kronos and the Titans are bad guys. I've never seen them. They were different phase in creation, just like Uranus was one of the protogeni, one of the progenitors. Each one was appropriate for the time that they ruled or oversaw, but they were outgrown. You know, the solutions that they found to the problems of the regime previously worked, but then they created a new set of problems which needed a new set of rulership. And there is, in actual, not in made-up modern or re-envisionings of the Greco-Roman, Mediterranean, Olympian, whatever you want to call it, mythology, that's evolved over the years. And all new mythical systems that continue the story or the adventure of these gods have developed organically over the millennia. They're not very well known because the old forms are still adhered to, but they never stopped interacting with the world. They've continued to interact with the world, and they've left tons of stories behind if you know where to find them.
And that's the thing about the old gods never... That's the hilarious thing about Reconstructionism, thinking the old gods have just gone away.
Right. They never went anywhere. They're on the sides of buildings. They're in our pictures. They're on our television sets. They're in our comic books. They're still there. And we know who they are and what they represent. And they're not depicted as perfect beings. They're in a stage of development. It might be higher than the one we're currently going through, but they too are developing, growing, evolving, and they make that very clear through their stories. Sometimes they show you what to do, and sometimes they'll show you what not to do, and the story will make it clear why it's not wise to do a particular thing in a particular way.
Yeah. But on some level, this is the conversation about God to have similar powers, like, say, Thor and Michael and Lou, the same because they have different rules.
Correct.
That on some level, when you choose a patron, you are choosing a tribe and the tribal rules.
Right. Like, for instance, with the Norse, I spent many years with the Hyperborean Norse pantheon, and there it is, their heaven is Valhalla, continuous conflict. So life became, not always, but much of the time, a continuous conflict, continuous struggle, you know, where you were beset by conflict and you had to assert your will by matching and the energies and triumphing over them. And that was the heaven, and that's what it promised you. Whereas with others, it was something very different. Hercules in the Greek form, for instance, is constantly testing himself, not in the same arena, but in different arenas, and taking full responsibility for everything you do, even if you didn't directly do it, even if it was some unconscious part of yourself causing it, you still did it. So it's all about taking responsibility and trying to make the right choice. You know, trying to serve areti and not kakia, you know.
The greater good.
Yeah.
The
so
greater good.
It's striving, even though you're falling short, with trying to serve the greater good and atone for any wrongdoings you might have done. And that's what that path is. But and there are post-labor paths as well. But if you're on the labor path, if you're on the Greek path, that's what you're doing, and your life becomes that, a never-ending series of contests, you know, where you need to figure out what to do and to do it in the best possible way to help other people as well as develop for yourself. Those are the paths to becoming, and we know unconsciously because we're gravitating toward the stories at all times through our music, through what we watch on TV, through what we read in comic books or in books. So there's a mechanism inside that draws us to the appropriate god or goddess, and we keep going back there because the divine likes to look in mirrors, and they're often depicted looking in mirrors.
And the divine likes the people it already has.
Yes.
There's an issue about how if you've been in, say, an Egyptian goddess's heaven, they're going to do their best to recruit you back.
Right. But sometimes...
Because part of what they want is stability, especially the Egyptians.
Sometimes,
and that's part of. No, go ahead.
Sometimes it's also just a friendly hi and a message of some sort. Like, for instance, not too long ago, I had the energies of Odin pop up. And Odin, when I followed the North Path, again, that came to mean something that I learned over experience. So when Odin's in the picture, it means certain things are about to be set in motion. So usually very extreme things that facilitate needed change. They're not pleasant to go through, but when it's done, your reality, if you learn the what you're supposed to learn, is redefined in a very positive way, and the door is open to move forward. So I understood that when Odin recently appeared. And the conflict came very quickly, and it was very earth-shattering, but I got something positive out of it, and it led to good things faster because I wasn't caught up in the drama of it. I understood what it meant when he appeared. So I took that as a friendly heads up, and not so much an invitation to immerse myself back in the mythology, although four primers have been appearing very much of late, so maybe I should reconsider the message I got.
Yeah, but that's the thing about listening when the gods appear, like my weird thing with Papa Legba on the Red Line last night.
Mm-hmm.
And then walking in to buy his rum and getting the Santeria song. That can't be a coincidence.
Right.
Even if I was a lower level person, that would freak me out. But because I'm so used to him by now, I'm like, well, the trains in Chicago and transportation in Chicago is not working right. So someone asked Papa Legba for help yesterday and actually wrote it on the train itself. And when I went to do something about it today, I just happened to get that Santeria song. Because of how the gods are really active in our real lives, if you're listening.
Yes. We're approaching the end of today's conversation. We have around 5 minutes left. So we'll start wrapping up. This definitely deserves a part two. And we'll schedule it before our normal conversation. This way we can continue it later this month.
Yeah, we were talking about doing another episode on the 29th or so.
Yes, one of the last Sunday of the month, the fifth Sunday. So what thoughts would you like to leave with people before we conclude today's conversation? And especially, how can they learn to listen to these messages? Because you're right, they're constant and continuous if we look for them or remain aware of them or anticipate them.
Well, I mean, as Allegra just demonstrated to me, they could look really random. It could look really random for me to see, but why would someone write Papa Allegra on a train car? It's really weird.
Yes, it
and
is.
And then because of my... Yeah, it's really weird. I think anyone else would have, like, freaked out at that. I'm just like, uh-huh, yeah. Trains aren't working right, Lord of the Crossroads. Let's get on it. And then when I try to do something to get on it, when I go to buy Allegra his rum this week, I get the Santeria song. So obviously Allegra's like, yeah, I know. I know. Don't write a letter. It's all right. But I think part of it is paying attention to your dreams, and part of it is paying attention to... But see, in white America, we're not used to understanding that everybody is God.
Right.
We're not used to... The children of the gods are all around us. We just need to listen. Part of understanding the children of gods are all around us. We just need to listen is... A leg was right there at the bus stop. If I just give him a cigarette, he and I are just going to chill and talk about what's bothering both of us. And then he knows where I am and I know where he is. In the same way, when I call you, Zeus knows where Hecate is and Hecate knows where Zeus is. About whatever the big politics is this week. Whether it's about Finland joining NATO or whatever, part of it is the very easy Bronze Age respect that when you know that everyone is God, you have more compassion and you treat people differently.
Right.
And you don't make the same mistakes because one of the gods warned you not to do that.
Right.
And if you live in a complicated, polytheistic, multi-tribal, cosmopolitan universe, does it really matter whether the goddess who told you not to do that is the Morrigan or Freya or Sekhmet? If she's the one sitting next to you at the bar and she wanted to talk, why weren't you listening? You were told. You were told.
Right. And on that note,
and on some level, well, but on some level, that also fixes our political problem. If we all understand everyone is a child of God, if we all understand Namaste or Anka, because Anka probably means the same thing as Namaste. If we all understand that, why are we treating each other this way?
And that's where we'll pick up at the end of the month. Satori, thank you very much. Always awesome and mind-expanding speaking with you. Always much to think about afterwards. And give me a call. Let's continue our conversation. Let's plan the next one.
Okay.
And thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you dialed patient waiting in your queue, or whether you'll listen on demand in a little while. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures.